books. Well, he'd have those, one way or another. Every president did. Even Grant and Harding were remembered. And with what was happening, even here he craved being remembered. And so he did what the woman wanted, if the woman had the wit to ask. "Turn the sound up," Liz said. Fowler complied at once. She was gratified to see. So eager to please, even in this. So why the hell had he let some servant in with the coffee? There was no understanding this man. He was already reading over the faxes from Rome. "My dear, this is going to work. I hope your bags are packed, Elizabeth." "Oh?" "The Saudis and the Israelis actually agreed on the big one last night. According to Brent..." "God, this is amazing." "He had separate solo sessions with both sides, and both of them suggested the same thing. And to keep them from knowing it, he simply cycled back and forth as he said it would probably be acceptable, then confirmed it on another round trip." "Ha!" Fowler slapped the back of his hand on the page. "Brent is really delivering for us. And that Ryan guy, too. He's a pretentious pain in the ass, but that idea of his..." "Come on, Bob. It wasn't even original. Ryan just repeated some things other people have been saying for years. It was new to Arnie, but Arnie's interests stop at the White House fence. Giving credit to Ryan for this is like saying he managed a nice sunset for you." "Maybe," the president allowed. He thought there was more to the DDCI's concept proposal than that, but it wasn't worth upsetting Elizabeth about. "Ryan did do a nice job with the Saudis, remember? He'd be a lot more effective if he'd just keep his mouth shut. Fine, he gave the Saudis a good brief. That's not exactly a great moment in American foreign policy, is it? Giving briefs is his job. Brent and Dennis are the guys who really pulled it together, not Ryan."
"I suppose not. You're right, I guess. Brent and Dennis are the ones who got the final commitments to the conference. Brent says 3 more days, maybe 4. The president handed the faxes over. It was time for him to rise and prepare for a day's work, but before he did, he ran a hand over a particular curve in the sheet, just to let her know that...
"Stop that," Liz giggled to make it sound playful. "He did as told, of course." To ease the blow, she leaned over for a kiss, which was delivered, bad breath and all, just as requested.
"What gives?" a truck driver asked at the lumber terminal. 4 enormous trailers sat in a line away from the stacks of felled trees being prepared for shipment to Japan.
"They were here last time, too."
"Going to Japan," the dispatcher observed, going over the trucker's manifest.
"So what here ain't?"
"Something special. They're paying to have those logs kept that way, renting the trailers and everything. I hear the logs are being made into beams for a church or temple or something. Look close. They're chained together. Tied with a silk rope, too, but chains to make sure they stay together. Something about the tradition of the temple or something. Going to be a bitch of a rigging job to load them on the ship that way."
"Renting the trailers just to keep the logs in a special place?
Chaining them together.
Jeez. They got more money and brains, don't they?"
"What do we care?" the dispatcher asked, tired of answering the same question every time a driver came through his office. And they were sitting there. The idea, the dispatcher thought, was to let the logs season some. But whoever had thought that one up hadn't been thinking very clearly. This was the wettest summer on record in an area known for its precipitation, and the logs, which had been heavy with moisture when their parent tree had been felled, were merely soaking up more rain as it fell down across the yard. The stubs of branches trimmed off in the field hadn't helped much either. The rain just soaked into the exposed capillaries and proceeded into the trunk. The logs were probably heavier now than when they had been cut. Maybe they should throw a tarp over them, the dispatcher thought. But then they'd just be trapping the moisture in. And besides, the orders were to let them sit on the trailers. It was raining now. The yard was turning into a damn swamp, the mud churned by every passing truck and loading machine. Well, the Japanese probably had their own plans for seasoning and working the logs. Their orders precluded doing any real seasoning here, and it was their money. Even when they were loaded on the ship, they were supposed to be carried topside, the last items loaded on the MV George MacCready for shipment across the Pacific. Sure as hell they'd get wet that way, too. If they got much wetter, the dispatcher thought, someone would have to be careful with them. If they got dropped into the river, they would scarcely float. The farmer knew that his grandchildren were embarrassed by his backwardness. They resisted his hugs and kisses, probably complained a little before their father brought them out here. But he didn't mind. Children today lacked the respect of his generation. Perhaps that was a price for their greater opportunities. The cycle of the ages was breaking. His life had been little different from 10 generations of ancestors, but his son was doing better despite his injuries, and his children would do better still. The boys were proud of their father. If their schoolmates commented adversely on their Druze religion, the boys could point out that their father had fought and bled against the hated Israelis, had even killed a few of the Zionists. The Syrian government was not totally ungrateful to its wounded veterans. The farmer's son had his own modest business, and government officials did not harass him as they might otherwise have done. He'd married late, which was unusual for the area. His wife was pretty enough and respectful. She treated the farmer well, possibly in gratitude for the fact that he had never shown an interest in moving into her small household. The farmer showed great pride in his grandchildren, strong, healthy boys, headstrong and rebellious as boys should be. The farmer's son was similarly proud, and was prospering. He and his father walked outside after the noon meal. The son looked at the garden that he'd once weeded, and felt pangs of guilt that his father was still working there every day. But hadn't he offered to take his father in? Hadn't he offered to give his father a little money? All such offers had been rejected. His father didn't have much, but he did have his stubborn pride. The garden looks very healthy this year. The rain has been very good, the farmer agreed. There are many new lambs. It has not been a bad year. And you? My best year. Father, I wish you did not have to work so hard. A wave of the hand. What other life have I known? This is my place. The courage of the man, the son thought. And the old man did have courage. He endured, despite everything. He had not been able to give his son much, but he had passed along his stoic courage. When he'd found himself lying stunned on the Golan Heights, 20 meters from the smoking wreckage of the personnel carrier, he could have just lain down to die, the son knew, his eye put out and his left hand a bloody mess that doctors would later have to remove. He could have just lain there on the ground and died, but he'd known that giving up was not something his father would have done. And so he'd risen and walked 6 kilometers to a battalion aid station, arriving there still carrying his rifle and accepting treatment only after making his report. He had a decoration for that, and his battalion commander had made life a little easier for him, giving him some money to start his little shop, making sure that local officials knew that he was to be treated with respect. The colonel had given him the money, but his father had given him the courage. If only he would now accept a little help. My son, I need your advice. That was something new. Certainly, father. Come, I will show you. He led his son into the garden where the carrots were. With his foot, he scraped dirt off the...
Stop!
The son nearly screamed. He took his father by the arm and pulled him back.
My God! How long has that been there?
Since the day you were hurt, the farmer answered.
The son's right hand went to his eye patch, and for one horrid moment the terror of the day came back to him. The blinding flash, flying through the air, his dead comrades screaming as they burned to death. The Israelis had done that. One of their cannons had killed his mother. And now, this? What was it?
He commanded his father to stay put and walked back to sea. He moved very carefully, as though he were traversing a minefield. His assignment in the army had been with the combat engineers. Though his unit had been committed to battle with the infantry, their job was supposed to have been laying a minefield. It was big. It looked like a 1,000-kilo bomb. It had to be Israeli. He knew that from the color. He turned to look at his father.
This has been here since then?
Yes. It made its own hole, and I filled it in. The frost must have brought it up. Is there danger? It is broken, no?
Father, these things never truly die. It is very dangerous. Big as it is, if it goes off, it could destroy the house and you in it.
The farmer gestured contempt for the thing. If it wanted to explode, it would have done so when it fell.
That is not true. You will listen to me on this. You will not come close to this cursed thing.
And what of my garden? The farmer asked simply. I will find a way to have this removed. Then you can garden. The son considered that. It would be a problem. Not a small problem either. The Syrian army did not have a pool of skilled people to disarm unexploded bombs. Their method was to detonate them in place, which was eminently sensible, but his father would not long survive the destruction of his house. His wife would not easily tolerate having him in their own home, and he could not help his father rebuild, not with only one hand. The bomb had to be removed. But who would do that? You must promise me that you will not enter the garden, the son announced sternly. As you say, the farmer replied. He had no intention of following his son's orders. When can you have it removed? I don't know. I need a few days to see what I can do. The farmer nodded. Perhaps he'd follow his son's instructions after all, at least about not approaching this dead bomb. It had to be dead, of course, despite what his son had said. The farmer knew that much of fate. If the bomb had wanted to kill him, it would have happened by now. What other misfortune had avoided him? The newsies finally got something to sink their teeth into the next day. Dimitrios Stavrakos, Patriarch of Constantinople, arrived by car. He refused to fly in helicopters, in broad daylight. A nun with a beard? A cameraman asked over his hot mic as he zoomed in. The Swiss guards at the door rendered honors, and Bishop O'Toole conducted the new visitor inside and out of view. Greek, the anchorman observed at once. Greek Orthodox, must be a bishop or something. What's he doing here? The anchor mused. What do we know about the Greek Orthodox Church? His producer asked. They don't work for the Pope. They allow their priests to marry. The Israelis threw one of them in prison once for giving arms to the Arabs, I think, someone else observed over the line. So the Greeks get along with the Arabs, but not the Pope? What about the Israelis? Don't know. The producer admitted. Might be a good idea to find out. So now there are 4 religious groups involved. Is the Vatican really involved, or did they just offer this place as neutral ground? The anchor asked. Like most anchormen, he was at his best when reading copy from a teleprompter. When has this happened before? If you want neutral, you go to Geneva, the cameraman observed. He liked Geneva. What gives? One of the researchers entered the booth. The producer filled her in. Where's that damned consultant? The anchor growled. Can you run the tape back? The researcher asked. The control room crew did that, and she freeze-framed the monitor. Dimitrios Stavrakos. He's the Patriarch of Constantinople. Istanbul to you, Rick. He's the head of all the Orthodox churches, kind of like the Pope. The Greek, Russian, and Bulgarian Orthodox churches have their own heads, but they all defer to the Patriarch. Something like that. They allow their priests to marry, don't they? Their priests, yes. But as I recall, if you become a bishop or higher, you have to be celibate. Bummer, Rick observed. Stavrakos led the battle with the Catholics over the Church of the Nativity last year. Won it, too, as I recall. He really pissed a few Catholic bishops off. What the hell is he doing here? You're supposed to tell us that, Angie, the anchor noted crossly. Hold your water, Rick. Angie Morales was tired of dealing with the airheaded prima donna. She sipped at her coffee for a minute or two and made her announcement. I think I have this figured out. You mind filling us in? Welcome. Cardinal D'Antonio kissed Stavrakos on both cheeks. He found the man's beard distasteful, but that could not be helped. The cardinal led the patriarch into the conference room. There were 16 people grouped around a table, and at the foot of it was an empty chair. Stavrakos took it. Thank you for joining us, said Secretary Talbot. One does not reject an invitation of this sort, the patriarch replied. You've read the briefing material that had been delivered by messenger. It is very ambitious, Stavrakos allowed cautiously. Can you accept your role in the agreement? This was going awfully fast, the patriarch thought. But... Yes, he answered simply. I require plenipotentiary authority over all Christian shrines in the Holy Land. If that is agreed to, then I will gladly join your agreement. D'Antonio managed to keep his face impassive. He controlled his breathing and prayed rapidly for divine intervention. He'd never quite be able to decide whether he got it or not. It is very late in the day for such a sweeping demand. Heads turned. The speaker was Dmitry Popov, first deputy foreign minister of the Soviet Union. It is also inconsiderate to seek unilateral advantage when everyone here has conceded so much. Would you stand in the way of the accord on that basis alone? Stavrakos was not accustomed to such direct rebukes. The question of Christian shrines is not of direct significance to the agreement, Your Holiness, Secretary Talbot observed. We find your conditional willingness to participate disappointing. Perhaps I misunderstood the briefing material, Stavrakos allowed, covering his flanks. Could you perhaps clarify what my status would be? No way, the anchor snorted. Why not? Angela Morales replied. What else makes sense? It's just too much. It is a lot, Morales agreed. But what else fits? I'll believe it when I see it. You might not see it. Stavrakos doesn't much like the Roman Catholic Church. That battle they had last Christmas was a nasty one. How come we didn't report it then? Because we were too damn busy talking about the downturn in Christmas sales figures, you asshole, she didn't add. A separate commission, then? Stavrakos didn't like that. The Metropolitan wishes to send his own representative, Popov said. Dmitry Popov still believed in Marx rather than God, but the Russian Orthodox Church was Russian, and Russian participation in the agreement had to be real, however minor this point might appear. I must say that I find this matter curious. Do we hold up the agreement on the issue of which Christian church is the most influential? Our purpose here is to defuse a potential flashpoint for war between Jews and Muslims, and the Christians stand in the way, Popov asked the ceiling. A little theatrically, D'Antonio thought. This side issue is best left to a separate committee of Christian clerics, Cardinal D'Antonio finally allowed himself to say. I pledge you my word before God that sectarian squabbles are at an end. I've heard that before, Stavrakos reminded himself. And yet, how could he allow himself to be so petty? He reminded himself also of what the scriptures taught, and that he believed in every word of it. I am making a fool of myself, and doing it before the Romans and the Russians. An additional consideration was that the Turks merely tolerated his presence in Istanbul, Constantinople, and this gave him the chance to earn immense prestige for his churches and his office. Please forgive me. I have allowed some regrettable incidents to color my better judgment. Yes, I will support this agreement, and I will trust my brethren to keep their word.
Brent Talbot leaned back in his chair and whispered his own prayer of thanks. Praying wasn't a habit with the Secretary of State, but here, in these surroundings, how could one avoid it? In that case, I believe we have an agreement. Talbot looked around the table, and one after another the heads nodded, some with enthusiasm, some with resignation. But they all nodded. They had reached an agreement.
Mr. Adler, when will the documents be ready for initialing? D'Antonio asked.
2 hours, Your Eminence.
Your Highness, Talbot said as he rose to his feet. Your Eminences, Ministers, we have done it.
Strangely, they scarcely realized what they had done. The process had lasted for quite some time, and as with all such negotiations, the process had become reality, and the objective had become something separate from it. Now suddenly, they were at the place they all intended to reach, and the wonder of the fact gave to them a sense of unreality that, for all their collective expertise at formulating and reaching foreign policy goals, overcame their perceptions. Each of the participants stood as Talbot did, and the movement, the stretch of legs, altered their perceptions somewhat. One by one, they understood what they had done. More importantly, they understood that they had actually done it. The impossible had just happened.
David Askenazi walked around the table to Prince Ali, who had handled his country's part in the negotiations, and extended his hand. That wasn't good enough. The prince gave the minister a brotherly embrace.
Before God, there will be peace between us, David.
After all these years, Ali, replied the former Israeli tanker. As a lieutenant, Askenazi had fought in the Suez in 1956, again as a captain in 1967, and his reserve battalion had reinforced the Golan in 1973. Both men were surprised by the applause that broke out. The Israeli burst into tears, embarrassing himself beyond belief.
Do not be ashamed. Your personal courage is well known, Minister, Ali said graciously. It is fitting that a soldier should make the peace, David.
So many deaths. All those fine young boys who... On both sides, Ali. All those boys.
But no more.
Dmitri, your help was extraordinary, Talbot told his Russian counterpart at the other end of the table. Remarkable what can happen when we cooperate, is it not?
What occurred to Talbot had come already to Askenazi.
2 whole generations pissed away, Dmitri. All that wasted time.
We cannot recover lost time, Popov replied. We can have the wit not to lose any more.
The Russian smiled crookedly.
For moments like this, there should be vodka.
Talbot jerked his head toward Prince Ali.
We don't all drink. How can they live without vodka?
Popov chuckled.
One of the mysteries of life, Dmitri. We both have cables to send.
Indeed we do, my friend.
To the fury of the correspondents in Rome, the first to break the story was a Washington Post reporter in Washington. It was inevitable. She had a source, an Air Force sergeant who did electronic maintenance on the VC-25A, the president's new military version of the Boeing 747. The sergeant had been prepped by the reporter. Everyone knew that the president was heading to Rome. It was just a question of when. As soon as the sergeant learned that she'd be heading out, she'd ostensibly called home to check that her good uniform was back from the cleaners. That she had called the wrong number was an honest mistake. It was just that the reporter had the same gag message on her answering machine. That was the story she'd use if she ever got caught, but she didn't in this case, and didn't ever expect to be. An hour later, at the routine morning meeting between the president's press secretary and the White House correspondents, the Post reporter announced an unconfirmed report that Fowler was going to Rome. And did this mean that the treaty negotiations had reached an impasse or success? The press secretary was caught short by that. He'd just learned 10 minutes before that he'd be flying to Rome, and as usual was sworn to total secrecy, an admonition that carried about as much weight as sunlight on a cloudy day. He allowed himself to be surprised by the question, though, and that surprised the man who had fully expected to engineer the leak, but only after lunch at the afternoon briefing. His no comment hadn't carried enough conviction, and the White House correspondents smelled the blood in the water. They all had edited copies of the president's appointment schedule, and sure enough, there were names to check with. The president's aides were already making calls to cancel appointments and appearances. Even the president cannot allow important people to be inconvenienced without warning, and while those might keep secrets, not all of their assistants and secretaries can. It was a classic case of the phenomenon upon which a free press depends. People who know things cannot keep them inside, especially secret things. Within an hour, confirmation was obtained from 4 widely separated sources. President Fowler had canceled several days' worth of appointments. The president was going somewhere, and it wasn't Peoria. That was enough for all the TV networks to run bulletins timed to erase segments of various game shows with hastily written statements, which immediately cut to commercials, denying millions of people the knowledge of what the word or phrase was, but informing them of the best way to get their clothes clean, despite deep grass stains. It was late afternoon in Rome, a sultry, humid summer day, when the pool headquarters was told that 3, only 3 cameras, and no correspondents would be permitted into the building whose outside had been subjected to weeks of careful scrutiny. In the green room trailers near each of the anchor booths, the network anchors on duty had makeup applied and hustled to their chairs, putting their earpieces in and waiting for word from their directors. The picture that appeared simultaneously on the booth monitors and TV sets all over the world showed the conference room. In it was a large table, all of whose seats were filled. At its head was the Pope, and before him was a folder of folio size, made of red calfskin. The reporters would never know of the momentary panic that had erupted when someone realized that he didn't know what kind of leather it was and had to check with the supplier. Fortunately, no one objected to the skin of a calf. It had been agreed that no statement would be made here. Preliminary statements would be made in the capitals of each of the participants, and the really flowery speeches were being drafted for the formal signing ceremonies. A Vatican spokesman delivered a written release to all of the TV correspondents. It said, in essence, that a draft treaty concerning a final settlement of the Middle East dispute had been negotiated, and that the draft was ready for initialing by representatives of the interested nations. The formal treaty documents would be signed by the chiefs of state and/or foreign ministers in several days. The text of the treaty was not available for release, nor were its provisions. This did not exactly thrill the correspondents, mainly because they realized that the treaty details would be broken from the foreign ministries in the respective capitals of the concerned nations to other reporters. The red folder was passed from place to place. The order of the initialers, the Vatican statement pointed out, had been determined by lot, and it turned out that the Israeli foreign minister went first, followed by the Soviet, the Swiss, the American, the Saudi, and the Vatican representatives. Each used a fountain pen, and a curved blotter was applied to each set of initials by the priest who moved the document from place to place. It wasn't much of a ceremony, and it was swiftly accomplished. Handshakes came next, followed by a lengthy bit of mutual applause. And that was it.
"By God," Jack said, watching the TV picture change. He looked down to the facts of the treaty outline, and it was not very different from his original concept. The Saudis had made changes, as had the Israelis, the Soviets, the Swiss, and, of course, the State Department. But the original idea was his, except insofar as he himself had borrowed ideas from a multitude of others. There were few genuinely original ideas.
What he'd really done had been to organize them and pick an historically correct moment to make his comment. That was all. For all that, it was the proudest moment of his life. It was a shame that there was no one to congratulate him. In the White House, President Fowler's best speechwriter was already working on the first draft of his speech. The American president would have primacy of place at the ceremony, because it had been his idea, after all, his speech before the UN that had brought them all together in Rome. The Pope would speak. Hell, they would all speak, the speechwriter thought, and for her that was a problem, since each speech had to be original and unrepetitive. She realized that she'd probably still be working on it while hopping the Atlantic on the 25A, pecking busily away on her laptop. But that, she knew, was what they paid her for, and Air Force One had a laser jet printer. Upstairs in the Oval Office, the president was looking over his hastily revised schedule. A committee of new Eagle Scouts would have to be disappointed, as would the new Wisconsin Cheese Queen, or whatever the young lady's title was, and a multitude of business people whose importance in their own small ponds quite literally paled when they entered the side door into the president's workshop. His appointments secretary was getting the word out. Some people whose visits were genuinely important were being shoehorned into every spare minute of the next 36 hours. That would make the president's next day and a half as hectic as it ever got, but that, too, was part of the job. Well? Fowler looked up to see Elizabeth Elliot grinning at him through the open door to the secretary's anteroom.
Well, this is what you wanted, isn't it? Your presidency will forever be remembered as the one in which the Middle East problems were settled once and for all. If, Liz admitted to herself in a rare moment of objective clarity, it all works out, which is not a given in such disputes as this.
We have done a service to the whole world, Elizabeth. By we, he actually meant I, Elliot knew, but that was fair enough. It was Bob Fowler who'd endured the months of campaigning on top of his executive duties in Columbus. The endless speeches, kissing babies and kissing ass, stroking legions of reporters whose faces changed far more rapidly than their brutally repetitive questions. It was an endurance race to get into this one small room, this seat of executive power. It was a process that somehow did not break the men. Pity it was still only men, Liz thought, who made it safely here. But the prize for all the effort, all the endless toil, was that the person who occupied it got to take the credit. It was a simple historical convention that people assumed the president was the one who directed things, who made the decisions. Because of that, the president was the one who got the kudos and the barbs. The president was responsible for what went well and for what went badly. Mostly that concerned domestic affairs, the blips in the unemployment figures, interest rates, inflation, wholesale and retail, and the all-powerful leading economic indicators. But on rare occasions, something really important happened. Something that changed the world. Reagan, Elliot admitted to herself, would be remembered by history as the guy who happened to be around when the Russians decided to cash in their chips on Marxism, and Bush was the man who collected that particular political pot. Nixon was the man who'd opened the door to China, and Carter the one who had come so tantalizingly close to doing what Fowler would now be remembered for. The American voters might select their political leaders for pocketbook issues, but history was made of more important stuff. What earned a man a few paragraphs in a general history text and focused volumes of scholarly study were the fundamental changes in the shape of the political world. That was what really counted. Historians remembered the ones who shaped political events. Bismarck, not Edison, treating technological changes in society as though they were driven by political factors and not the reverse, which, she judged, might have been equally likely. But historiography had its own rules and conventions that had little to do with reality, because reality was too large a thing to grasp, even for academics working years after events. Politicians played within those rules, and that suited them because following those rules meant that when something memorable happened, the historians would remember them. Service to the world, Elliot responded after a lengthy pause. Service to the world. I like the sound of that. They called Wilson the man who kept us out of war. You will be remembered as the one who put an end to war. Fowler and Elliot both knew that scant months after being re-elected on that platform, Wilson had led America into its first truly foreign war, the war to end all wars, optimists had called it, well before Holocaust and nuclear nightmares. But this time, both thought, it was more than mere optimism, and Wilson's transcendent vision of what the world could be was finally within the grasp of the political figures who made the world into the shape of their own choosing. The man was a Druze, an unbeliever, but for all that he was respected. He bore the scars of his own battle with the Zionists. He'd gone into battle and been decorated for his courage. He'd lost his mother to their inhuman weapons, and he'd supported the movement whenever asked. Conti was a man who had never lost touch with the fundamentals. As a boy, he'd read the Little Red Book of Chairman Mao. That Mao was, of course, an infidel of the worst sort. He'd refused even to acknowledge the idea of a god and persecuted those who worshipped, was beside the point. The revolutionary was a fish who swam in a peasant sea, and maintaining the goodwill of those peasants, or in this case, a shopkeeper, was the foundation of whatever success he might enjoy. This Druze had contributed what money he could, had once sheltered a wounded freedom fighter in his home. Such debts were not forgotten. Conti rose from his desk to greet the man with a warm handshake and the perfunctory kisses.
Welcome, my friend.
Thank you for seeing me, Commander.
The shopkeeper seemed very nervous, and Conti wondered what the problem was.
Please, take a chair. Abdullah, he called. Would you bring coffee for our guest?
You are too kind.
Nonsense. You are our comrade. Your friendship has not wavered in...
How many years?
The shopkeeper shrugged, smiling inwardly that this investment was about to pay off. He was frightened of Conti and his people. That was why he had never crossed them. He also kept Syrian authorities informed of what he'd done for them, because he was wary of those people too. Mere survival in that part of the world was an art form, and a game of chance.
I come to you for advice, he said after his first sip of coffee.
Certainly.
Conti leaned forward in his chair.
I am honored to be of help. What is the problem, my friend?
It is my father.
How old is he now? Conti asked.
The farmer had occasionally given his men gifts also, most often a lamb. Just a peasant, and an infidel peasant at that, but he was one who shared his enemy with Conti and his men.
66. You know his garden?
Yes, I was there some years ago, soon after your mother was killed by the Zionists, Conti reminded him.
In his garden, there is an Israeli bomb.
Bomb? You mean a shell?
No, Commander, a bomb. What you can see of it is half a meter across.
I see. And if the Syrians learn of it?
Yes. As you know, they explode such things in place. My father's house would be destroyed.
The visitor held up his left forearm. I cannot be of much help rebuilding it, and my father is too old to do it himself. I come here to ask how one might go about removing the damned thing. You have come to the right place. Do you know how long it has been there?
My father says that it fell the very day this happened to me.
The shopkeeper gestured with his ruined arm again. Then surely Allah smiled on your family that day.
Some smile, the shopkeeper thought,
nodding. You have been our most faithful friend.
Of course we can help you. I have a man highly skilled in the business of disarming and removing Israeli bombs. And then he takes the guts from them and makes bombs for our use. Kati stopped and held up an admonishing finger. You must never repeat that. The visitor jerked somewhat in his chair. For my part, Commander, you may kill all of them you wish. And if you can do it from a bomb the pigs dropped into my father's garden, I will pray for your safety and success. Please excuse me, my friend. No insult was intended. I must say such things, as you can understand. Kati's message was fully understood. I will never betray you, the shopkeeper announced forcefully. I know this. Now it was time to keep faith with the peasant C. Tomorrow I will send my man to your father's home. Inshallah, he said, God willing. I am in your debt, Commander. Sometime between now and the new year, he hoped.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
The Sum of All Fears by Tom Clancy. Chapter 8. The Pandora Process. The converted Boeing 747 rotated off the Andrews runway just before sunset. President Fowler had had a bad day and a half of briefings and unbreakable appointments. He would have two more, even worse. Even presidents are subject to the vagaries of ordinary human existence, and in this case, the 8-hour flight to Rome was coupled with a 6-hour time change. The jet lag would be a killer. Fowler was a seasoned enough traveler to know that. To attenuate the worst of it, he'd fiddled with his sleep pattern yesterday and today so that he'd be sufficiently tired to sleep most of the way across, and the VC-25A had lavish accommodations to make the flight as comfortable as Boeing and the United States Air Force could arrange. An easy-riding aircraft, the 25A had its presidential accommodations in the very tip of the nose. The bed, actually a convertible sofa, was of decent size, and the mattress had been selected for his personal taste. The aircraft was also large enough that a proper separation between the press and the administration people was possible. Nearly 200 feet, in fact. The press was in a closed-off section in the tail, and while his press secretary was dealing with the reporters aft, Fowler was discreetly joined by his national security adviser. Pete Connor and Helen D'Agostino shared a look that an outsider might take to be blank, but which spoke volumes within the close fraternity of the Secret Service. The Air Force security policeman assigned to the door just stared at the aft bulkhead, trying not to smile.
So, Ibrahim, what of our visitor? Kati asked. He is strong, fearless, and quite cunning. But I don't know what possible use we have for him, Ibrahim Gon replied. He related the story of the Greek policeman. Broke his neck. At least the man was not a plant. That is, if the policeman had really died, and this was not an elaborate ruse of the Americans, Greeks, Israelis, or God only knew who.
Like a twig.
His contacts in America?
They are few. He is hunted by their national police. His group, he says, killed 3 of them, and his brother was recently ambushed and murdered by them.
He is ambitious in his choice of enemies. His education?
Poor in formal terms, but he is clever.
Skills?
Few that are of use to us.
He is an American, Kati pointed out. How many of those have we had? Gon nodded.
That is true, Commander.
The chance that he could be an infiltrator?
I would say slim, but we must be careful.
In any case, I have something I need you to do, Kati explained about the bomb.
Another one.
Gon was an expert at this task, but he was not exactly excited about being stuck with it. I know the farm. That foolish old man. I know his son fought against the Israelis, and you like the cripple. That cripple saved the life of a comrade. Fuzzy would have bled to death had he not received shelter in that little shop. He didn't have to do that. That was at a time when the Syrians were angry with us. All right. I have nothing to do for the rest of the day. I need a truck and a few men. This new friend is strong, you say. Take him with you. As you say, Commander. And be careful. Inshallah. Ghosn was almost a graduate of the American University of Beirut. Almost because one of his teachers had been kidnapped, and two others had used that as an excuse to leave the country. That had denied Ghosn the last 9 credit hours needed for a degree in engineering. Not that he really needed it. He'd been at the top of his class and learned well enough from the textbooks without having to listen to the explanations of instructors. He'd spent quite a bit of time in labs of his own making. Ghosn had never been a front-line soldier of the movement. Though he knew how to use small arms, his skills with explosives and electronic devices were too valuable to be risked. He was also youthful in appearance, handsome, and quite fair-skinned, as a result of which he traveled a lot. An advance man of sorts, he often surveyed sites for future operations, using his engineer's eye and memory to sketch maps, determine equipment needs, and provide technical support for the actual operations people, who treated him with far more respect than an outsider might have expected. Of his courage, there was no doubt. He'd proven his bravery more than once, defusing unexploded bombs and shells that the Israelis had left in Lebanon, then reworking the explosives recovered into bombs of his own. Ibrahim Ghosn would have been a welcome addition to any one of a dozen professional organizations anywhere in the world. A gifted, if largely self-taught engineer, he was also a Palestinian whose family had evacuated Israel at the time of the country's founding, confidently expecting to return as soon as the Arab armies of the time erased the invaders quickly and easily. But that happy circumstance had not come about, and his childhood memories were of crowded, unsanitary camps where antipathy for Israel had been a creed as important as Islam. It could not have been otherwise. Disregarded by the Israelis as people who had voluntarily left their country, largely ignored by other Arab nations who might have made their lot easier but had not, Ghosn and those like him were mere pawns in a great game whose players had never agreed upon the rules. Hatred of Israel and its friends came as naturally as breathing, and finding ways to end the lives of such people was his task in life. It had never occurred to him to wonder why. Ghosn got the keys for a Czech-built Gaz-66 truck. It wasn't as reliable as a Mercedes, but a lot easier to obtain. In this case, it had been funneled to his organization through the Syrians years before. On the back was a home-built A-frame. Ghosn loaded the American in the cab with himself and the driver. 2 other men rode on the load bed as the truck pulled out of the camp. Marvin Russell examined the terrain with the interest of a hunter in a new territory. The heat was oppressive, but really no worse than the Badlands during a bad summer wind, and the vegetation, or lack of it, wasn't all that different from the reservation of his youth. What appeared to others as bleak was just another dusty place to an American raised on one. Except here, they didn't have the towering thunderstorms, and the tornadoes they spawned of the American plains. The hills were also higher than the rolling Badlands. Russell had never seen mountains before. Here he saw them, high and dry and hot enough to make a climber gasp. Most climbers, Marvin Russell thought. He could hack it. He was in shape. Better shape than these Arabs. The Arabs, on the other hand, seemed to be believers in guns. So many guns. Mostly Russian AK-47s at first, but soon he was seeing heavy anti-aircraft guns and the odd battery of surface-to-air missiles, tanks, and self-propelled field guns belonging to the Syrian army. Ghosn noted his guest's interest and started explaining things. "These are here to keep the Israelis out," he said, casting his explanation in accordance with his own beliefs. "Your country arms the Israelis, and the Russians arm us. He didn't add that this was becoming increasingly tenuous.
Ibrahim, have you been attacked?
Many times, Marvin.
They send their aircraft. They send commando teams. They have killed thousands of my people. They drove us from our land, you see. We are forced to live in camps that...
Yeah, man. They're called reservations where I come from.
That was something Gon didn't know about. They came to our land, the land of our ancestors, killed off the buffalo, sent in their army, and massacred us. Mainly they attacked camps of women and children. We tried to fight back. We killed a whole regiment under General Custer at a place called the Little Bighorn. That's the name of a river, under a leader named Crazy Horse. But they didn't stop coming. Just too many of them. Too many soldiers. Too many guns. And they took the best of our land and left us shit, man. They make us live like beggars. No, that's not right. Like animals. Like we're not people, even, 'cause we look different, speak different, got a different religion. They did all that 'cause we were in a place they wanted to have. And they just moved us out, like sweeping away the garbage.
I didn't know about that, Gon said, amazed that his were not the only people to be treated that way by the Americans and their Israeli vassals. When did it happen?
100 years ago. Actually started around 1865. We fought, man. We did the best we could, but we didn't have much of a chance. We didn't have friends, see? Didn't have friends like you got. Nobody gave us guns and tanks. So they killed off the bravest. Mainly they trapped the leaders and murdered them. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull died like that. Then they squeezed us and starved us until we had to surrender. Left us dusty, shitty places to live. Sent us enough food to keep us alive, but not enough to be strong. When some of us try to fight back, try to be men. Well, I told you what they did to my brother. Shot him from ambush like he was an animal. Did it on television, even, so as people would know what happened when an Indian got too big for his britches. The man was a comrade, Gon realized. This was no infiltrator, and his story was no different from the story of a Palestinian.
Amazing. So why did you come here, Marvin?
I had to leave before they got me, man. I ain't proud of it, but what else could I do? You want me to wait till they could ambush me? Russell shrugged. I figured I'd come someplace, find people like me, maybe learn a few things, learn how I could go back, maybe, teach my people how to fight back some. Russell shook his head. Hell, maybe it's all hopeless, but I ain't gonna give in. You understand that?
Yes, my friend. I understand. It has been so with my people since before I was born. But you too must understand. It is not hopeless. So long as you stand up and fight back, there is always hope. That is why they hunt you. Because they fear you.
Hope you're right, man. Russell stared out the open window, and the dust stung his eyes. 7,000 miles from home. So, what are we doing?
When you fought the Americans, how did your warriors get weapons?
Mainly, we took what they left behind.
So it is with us, Marvin.
Fowler woke up about halfway across the Atlantic.
Well, that was a first, he told himself. He'd never managed to do it in an airplane before. He wondered if any U.S. president had, or done it on the way to see the Pope, or with his national security advisor. He looked out the windows. It was bright this far north. The aircraft was close to Greenland, and he wondered for a moment if it were morning or still night.
That was almost a metaphysical question on an airplane, of course, which changed the time far faster than a watch could. Also metaphysical was his mission. This would be remembered. Fowler knew his history. This was something unique. It had never happened before. Perhaps it was the beginning of the process, perhaps the end of it. But what he was up to was simply expressed. He would put an end to war. J. Robert Fowler's name would be associated with this treaty. It was the initiative of his presidential administration. His speech at the UN had called the nations of the world to the Vatican. His subordinates had run the negotiations. His name would be the first on the treaty documents. His armed forces would guarantee the peace. He had truly earned his place in history. That was immortality, the kind that all men wanted but few earned. Was it any wonder that he was excited? He asked himself with dispassionate reflectivity. A president's greatest fear was gone now. He'd asked himself that question from the first moment, the first fleeting, self-directed thought, while still a prosecutor chasing after the capo of the Cleveland family of the Cosa Nostra. If you're the president, what if you have to push the button? Could he have done it? Could he have decided that the security of his country required the deaths of thousands, millions of other human beings? Probably not, he judged. He was too good a man for that. His job was to protect people, to show them the way, to lead them along a beneficial path. They might not always understand that he was right and they wrong, that his vision was the correct one, the logical one. Fowler knew himself to be cold and aloof on such matters, but he was always right. Of that he was certain. He had to be certain of himself and his motivations. Were he ever wrong, he knew, his conviction would be mere arrogance, and he'd faced that charge often enough. The one thing he was unsure about was his ability to face a nuclear war. But that was no longer an issue, was it? Though he'd never admit it publicly, Reagan and Bush had ended that chance, forcing the Soviets to face their own contradictions and facing them to change their ways. And it had all happened in peace, because men really were more logical than beasts. There would continue to be hot spots, but so long as he did his job right, they would not get out of hand. And the trip he was making now would end the most dangerous problem remaining in the world, the one with which no recent administration could cope. What Nixon and Kissinger had failed to do, what had defied the valiant efforts of Carter, the half-hearted attempts of Reagan, and the well-meaning gambits of Bush and his own predecessor, what all had failed to do, Bob Fowler would accomplish. It was a thought in which to bask. Not only would he find his place in the history books, but he would also make the rest of his presidency that much easier to manage. This would also put the seal on his second term. A 45-state majority, solid control of Congress, and the remainder of his sweeping social programs. With historic accomplishments like this one came international prestige and immense domestic clout. It was power of the best kind, earned in the best way, and the sort that he could put to the best possible use. With a stroke of a pen, actually several pens, for that was the custom, Fowler became great, a giant among the good, and a good man among the powerful. Not once in a generation did a single man have such a moment as this. Maybe not once in a century. And no one could take it away. The aircraft was traveling at 43,000 feet, moving at a ground speed of 633 knots. The placement of his cabin allowed him to look forward, as a president should look, and down at a world whose affairs he was managing so well. The ride was silky smooth, and Bob Fowler was going to make history. He looked over to Elizabeth, lying on her back, her right hand up around her head and the covers down at her waist, exposing her lovely chest to his eyes. While most of the rest of the passengers fidgeted in their seats, trying to get some sleep, he looked. Fowler didn't want to sleep right now. The president had never felt more like a man. A great man, to be sure. But at this moment, just a man. His hand slid across her breasts. Elizabeth's eyes opened wide, and she smiled, as though in her dreams